Today's episode is sponsored in part by Modern Mammals, creators of a new hair washing product for men. You can help support Based on a True Story when you use the code BOATSPODCAST at modernmammals.com for 10% off. I've really been enjoying their shampoo light bar as an alternative to traditional shampoo. And I know it's in the name, but honestly, when I first used it, I was surprised at just how light and airy it feels. It reminds me of using a bar of soap for your hair, except it's even better than that because if you're like me, you don't like the residue that some actual bars of soap leave behind. And the shampoo light bar is easy to wash out without leaving any residue behind. Modern Mammals also focuses on creating products that help you keep your hair's natural oils so it's not left feeling poofy and frizzy. Go to modernmammals.com and use code BOATSPODCAST for 10% off. Again, that's modernmammals.com for 10% off with promo code BOATSPODCAST. Don't forget to use the promo code BOATSPODCAST so they know I sent you. Thanks, Modern Mammals. Okay, let's start today's episode. Hello, and welcome to Based on a True Story, the podcast that compares your favorite Hollywood movies and TV shows with history. On today's episode, we're continuing our series on the HBO miniseries, Chernobyl. Now, there are five episodes in HBO's miniseries, so that means there will be five episodes in our series as well. And today, we're going to be looking at episode number three, which is called Open Wide, O Earth. This episode first aired on May 20th, 2019. Since this is episode number three, if you haven't already, I would highly recommend going back to listen to when we looked at the other episodes, number one and number two. We cover a lot of basics for how nuclear reactors work and how it's relevant, why it's important to the overall story. So we won't be repeating a lot of that information again. Instead, we'll build on it as needed for this episode and the rest of the series. You can find all the episodes for this series over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/Chernobyl. Before we start our story today, let's set up our game. Two truths and a lie. If you're new to the show, here's how it works. I'm about to say three things. Two of them are true, and that means one of them is an all-out lie. Are you ready? Okay, here they are. Number one, two of the three volunteers we see at the beginning of the episode actually died trying to turn the valves. Number two, the reactor exploded after the AZ-5 emergency shutoff button was pushed. Number three, Vasily Ignatenko's coffin was covered with cement. Got him? Okay, now as you're listening to our story today, your challenge is to identify which one is the lie. And of course, we'll do a recap at the end of the episode to see how well you did. So, how much of the third episode of Chernobyl really happened? I'm Dan Lefebvre, and this is Based on a True Story. Episode number three starts with a continuation of what we saw at the end of the last episode, number two. We're in darkness with the three men submerged in radioactive water, trying to turn the valves that'll avoid an even worse disaster. Unfortunately, their flashlights went out at the end of the last episode. In this one, they managed to get the lights working again, and they continue on. They also managed to find the valves and get them turned. In the next scene, we're back above ground where all three men are received with cheers and claps. They were successful. Finally, some good news. That's true. Setting up the terrible disaster they were trying to avoid by going into the water was something they showed in the last episode. So that's when we learned about that as well. The three men aren't listed in the credits for the HBO series with first names. They only have their last names. Ananenko, Bezpilov, and Baranov. Those really were the men who volunteered to go. But of course, there's more to the story than we see in the series. Alexei Ananenko knew where the valves were located because
He was a senior reactor mechanical engineer. Valery Bezpilov was a turbine engineer who was going to turn the second valve. And then Boris Baranov was a shift supervisor. He decided to go along with the other two men to both carry a flashlight for the others so they could see what they were doing, is using both hands to turn the valves. But he was also there in case of emergencies. He would rescue the other men and or be a backup to turn a valve in case something happened. So it wasn't like they were just random men that were selected or volunteering completely randomly. The whole ordeal with losing their light, like we see in the series, that actually happened too. Although they weren't able to get the light working again as fast as we see in the series. Instead, once their light failed, they had to feel their way in the darkness using the pipes to guide them to the valves. Of course, that wouldn't really look very good on screen, since pitch darkness, pitch black doesn't create good visuals. So I can see why they changed that in the series. The three men were told their families would be taken care of, although I couldn't find any proof in my research to know if that happened or not. While the men were expecting to sacrifice their lives for what they'd done, spending a lot of time in highly radioactive water will do that, they all seemed to survive the ordeal much better than others, actually. In one of the excellent books I used during my research for this episode, called 12340, the author, Andrew Leatherbarrow, mentions that he actually spoke with Alexei Ananenko in March of 2016, just before the first edition of Leatherbarrow's book was published. Valery Bezpilov was still alive in June of 2019, while Boris Baranov did die, but he died of a heart attack in 2005 at age 65. So, all in all, considering what they volunteered for in 1986, they all survived that, and all three men seemed to live rather normal lives afterwards. As I'm recording this right now, on the other side of my door is my cat. He's always wherever I am as I'm working on the podcast. He watches all the movies with me, and he lets me know when it's time to stop working by sitting on my keyboard. I love the little guy. And as a pet owner, that means there are expenses like vet bills that can pop up, and sometimes that's unexpected. That's why I was happy to learn about today's sponsor, EarnIn, because they can help make sure that I've got the money to cover those unexpected vet bills. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day or up to $750 per pay period. Now you can join over 3.5 million customers. Get the peace of mind that comes with EarnIn. Download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in True Story under podcast when you sign up. It'll really help the show. True Story under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC. Thanks, EarnIn. If we go back into the series, even though they're successful at avoiding the thermal explosion thanks to the three men turning the valves, they're far from being safe. The next major plot point happens as they're trying to solve the issue of the meltdown burning its way through the platform under the reactor and into the earth. If it does that, the radioactive material will leak into the drinking water and poison it for everyone around. To avoid that, the plan is to install a liquid nitrogen heat exchanger underneath the concrete pad. To do that in time, before it burns through the concrete pad, they need to bring in more men. According to the series, 100 coal miners from Tula in Russian SSR are brought in to do this. Valery Legasov and Boris Shcherbina tell the miners' crew chief, a man named Andrei Glukov, what the situation is. They don't beat around the bush. This job involves digging underneath a nuclear reactor that is actively melting down. But if we don't do it, the nearby river feeds into the primary water supply for about 50 million people. They could all be poisoned and lead to untold scores of deaths. There are elements of truth to this. Overall, the basic gist is true, although there is more to the story that we don't see. Again, for one, the character of Andrei Glukov was not a crew chief at a coal mine in Tula. You can read more about the real Glukov in Adam Higginbotham's book, Midnight in Chernobyl. Glukov actually worked in the reactor's physics laboratory at the Chernobyl power plant. He was a friend of Leonid Toptanov, and in the morning hours of April 26, just after the explosion, he called his friend to find out what happened. Couldn't get a hold of him at first for obvious reasons that we know now, but when he was finally able to get a hold of Toptanov, Glukov asked about Unit 4. Toptanov told his friend that he had been told not to talk about it, but go look out the window. So what of the miners that we see in the series then? There was a plan to dig beneath the reactor in May, but it was not the first plan after avoiding the threat of thermal explosion. The first idea the State Commission had was to try and cool the melting reactor core from beneath. To do this, they'd pump in liquid hydrogen underneath the reactor. That didn't work. Not because the plan was a bad one necessarily, but the drilling crews couldn't get close enough to Unit 4 because of the high levels of radiation. So that's when they had the idea to drill horizontally from a safe area behind Unit 3. That didn't work either. Again, it wasn't because the plan was a terrible one, but this time it was an issue with the equipment. What they had available at the time couldn't correctly build the entire frozen platform that would be needed to cool the reactor down. They could do parts here and there, but it just wasn't enough. As a quick little side note here, one of the ways the HBO series oversimplifies things is by suggesting there were basically three people, Shcherbina, Legasov, and Kumyuk. Basically, those three people are behind the ideas for how to solve a lot of the problems after the accident. We already learned there were hundreds of people involved, and that's especially relevant here as ideas for how to slow the meltdown were being bounced back and forth by scientists. They were basically in uncharted territories. It wasn't just like Valery Legasov came up with ideas like this series kind of suggests. In fact, many of the ideas that were proposed were ideas that Legasov didn't like. For example, one of Legasov's colleagues in the scientific community was a man named Yevgeny Velikov. And he was the one to propose freezing the earth under the reactor and then building a concrete platform. Legasov actually wasn't so sure of this idea. But it is true, there was an idea similar to what we see in the series, build a concrete platform that could be cooled. To do that, they would need to build a tunnel and then a chamber under the reactor for housing the freezing chamber that would be used to cool down the entire concrete platform. As an added benefit, they planned on the platform being used to help support a structure that would be built over the entire reactor. They anticipated it would need to be built to keep radioactivity from escaping after the immediate threat of the continuing meltdown was solved. To get this built, the series was correct to suggest there were people brought in from Tula. This series mentions in dialogue that there were 100 men who gather their equipment and get into trucks to head to Chernobyl. That's, again, kind of a simplification. According to Serhii Plokhii's book, Chernobyl, over 230 miners came from the Donbas region, as well as over 150 from Tula. On top of that, because of the delicacy of the situation, the miners were not allowed to use heavy mechanical equipment that they were accustomed to. The state committee didn't want to risk the heavy equipment damaging the foundation in any way. That could lead to releasing even more radioactive elements into the ground, which is what they were trying to avoid. What that meant for their workers was they basically had to dig things with shovels, or in many cases, literally by hand. There was a lot of digging and pushing dirt with bare hands. The miners worked for 3 hours at a time, and they did this all for free. At least that's what they thought. They thought they were doing it for free. They did end up getting paid rather well, considering for what they did. But they didn't know about any special compensation at the time. And by saying rather well, I mean not necessarily because of the risks involved, but for during the time period being 1986 in the Soviet Union. The special compensation came at a later time, not something that they knew. At the time, all they knew was if they didn't do it, No one would. They were doing a job they knew needed to be done to avoid poisoning the drinking water of millions of citizens. Something else that sort of underscores the complexities of reality compared to the HBO miniseries. Well, in the series, we see a bunch of miners arriving at Chernobyl on buses. In the true story, each miner was approved by the state committee before they could go to Chernobyl. But of course, you can't see everything in the series. Speaking of which, if we go back into the series, we're back at the hospital where some of the men at Chernobyl, when the explosion happened, are being treated. Men like Anatoly Dyatlov, Leonid Toptunov, and Alexander Akimov. Ulana Kumyuk visits the hospital to talk to them and get a picture of what happened in the control room that night. At first, Kumyuk tries to talk to Dyatlov, but he's not in the mood to talk, so she goes to talk to Toptunov. During their conversation, Toptunov tells Kumyuk that the power level jumped from 200 to 400 megawatts, super fast. Kumyuk asks him, why didn't he press the AZ5 button to initiate an emergency shutoff? Toptunov says he told Akimov about the increase, and it was Akimov who pressed the AZ5 button. Then something comes that seems to be a shock to Kumyuk. Toptunov tells her that it was only after Akimov pressed the AZ5 button that the reactor exploded. That doesn't make sense. Why would the reactor explode after the emergency shutoff button had been pressed? That's kind of the whole point of an emergency shutoff, to, you know, shut it off in the event of an emergency. Kumyuk verifies this, and Toptunov repeats that's what happened. The AZ5 button was pushed by Akimov, and then it exploded. So Kumyuk goes to talk to Akimov to get his side of things. He confirms it and tells Kumyuk that he pressed the AZ5 button before the explosion. But he's confused on why shutting it down didn't work. There are some elements of truth to that, but the specifics of what we're seeing here are made up for the series. If you recall, the character of Ulana Kumyuk is a fictional one that's intended to be an amalgamation of all the scientists who worked on the Chernobyl accident. So obviously, it wasn't just one person who was talking to three of the men in the control room to figure out what happened. There were a lot of people trying to get to the bottom of what happened, talking to a lot of the people who were working at the power plant that night, not just in the control room, but, you know, people that were working there around too. With that said, though, as we learned earlier in this series, the characters of Dyatlov, Toptunov, and Akimov were real people. And the things that Toptunov and Akimov tell Kumyuk in the series were also true. The AZ5 button was pressed just before the explosion occurred. That night, as they were running the test, Leonid Toptunov was looking at the computer data when he saw the power levels rising way too fast. Akimov was too busy focusing on the test that they were running, so he didn't notice the levels until Toptunov shouted to Akimov that the levels were rising way too fast. Akimov must have realized how serious the situation was because he ordered Toptunov to push the AZ5 button. So he did. We already learned what that button does in the first episode of this series, so I won't repeat all of that now, but just as a quick refresher, when the operator pushes the AZ5, all the control rods are inserted into the reactor at once to stop the fission reaction. It's not a normal thing to push AZ5, but think of it like the emergency brake in your car. If something goes wrong, you're probably going to use it. At least I would hope you do. Some cars these days have automated braking because they can sense a wreck, but you get the idea. It's not something you use on a daily basis. That's why it's called an emergency. And in the emergency, the AZ5 button should have stopped everything and let them take a breather to figure out exactly what happened. According to Dyatlov's recollection later, it was about 12 to 15 seconds after Toptunov pushed the AZ5 button that the reactor exploded. That's another big reason why everyone was so confused in the moments immediately following the explosion. There are obvious after effects of what an explosion must be like, but then there's the other part of it that just doesn't make sense. Imagine you're driving your car and you're driving down and then something happens and you reach for the emergency brake, you pull the emergency brake, And instead of your car slowing to a stop, as you'd imagine, that's what you'd expect. Instead of that happening, it just explodes. Wait, what? Why? That's not even something close to what's supposed to happen. So you can imagine the pure confusion and the immediate aftermath of that. If we go back to the series, as Kumyuk is leaving the hospital, she happens to notice Ludmila Ignatenko in a room with her husband, Vasily. If you recall, he was one of the first firefighters to arrive on the scene, and he's not looking good now. Ludmila wants to be with her husband so he doesn't die alone. It's understandable, but when Kumyuk sees that Ludmila is holding Vasily's hand, she scolds her and forces her out of the room. Ludmila is pregnant, you see, and she shouldn't be touching Vasily's hand. Kumyuk scolds the doctor in charge for letting it happen, something the doctor had told Ludmila not to do, but the doctor is also so overwhelmed with other patients that she didn't keep an eye on Ludmila. Then Kumyuk says something to the effect of how everyone is going to hear about this. Just then, two KGB agents step out of the shadows. They heard everything, and as you can imagine, they don't like the idea of Kumyuk telling anyone anything. So they arrest her. That's made up, but mostly for the reasons we've already talked about, Ulana Kumyuk is not real. However, Ludmila and Vasily Ignatenko were real people. There's a fantastic book, if you want to learn more about them, called Voices from Chernobyl, and it covers other people too, but it has stories from Ludmila as well. The book is from Svetlana Alexievich, and she interviewed the real Ludmila. It's so sad to read. It's not a happy story at all, but I think you probably know that by now. I can't replicate those words here, but if you want to dig into some of the stories of those who lost loved ones at Chernobyl like Ludmila did, check out Svetlana's book. As for the idea of Kumyuk being arrested like we see in the series, that didn't happen. How could it? Kumyuk wasn't a real person. But it is true that the KGB tried to silence, detain, and arrest people in an attempt to cover up what was happening at Chernobyl. In all honesty, we'll probably never know exactly how many people were arrested, like we see happen to Kumyuk in the series. But I don't really think we need to. The series is not even trying to be accurate here, because we know this is a fictional character who is portraying the idea of something that happened. On one hand, there was a state committee that was charged with figuring out what happened. On the other hand, the Soviet Union didn't want too much information getting out, especially to other countries. Going back to the series, at the end of the third episode, we see Legasov tracking down the head of the KGB, a man named Charkov. In their conversation, Charkov lets Legasov know the KGB is a circle of accountability, just like the old Russian proverb, trust but verify. And the Americans think Reagan came up with that. Charkov laughs. Then, after Legasov tells Charkov that he needs Kumyuk to continue his work, Charkov agrees to let her go on the condition that Legasov is held responsible for her from here on out. All of this is made up, of course. Again, we mentioned this, Kumyuk, not a real character, so she couldn't have gone to prison. What is real, though, is that the real KGB chairman, Viktor Chebrukov, was certainly involved in the Chernobyl situation. Something we don't really see much of in this series was just how much happened outside of the Chernobyl area. At Chebrukov's command, the KGB was very involved in trying to keep anyone who might try to report on the situation to foreign nationals in particular, like people like diplomats and news correspondents. The accident itself was no secret. It couldn't be, since, as we learned, neighboring countries were detecting radiation. It was showing up in media across the world. For example, there was a headline in London saying 2,000 people were killed, while the official death toll at Chernobyl was 2 people at the time. They claimed those 2 people were killed in the blast itself. The number of 2,000 was an estimate, mostly because foreign nations like the United States had satellites that had taken photographs of the damage. Even though they couldn't tell a lot of details from that, they knew at least 4,000 people worked at the power plant at any given time. So the idea that only 2 people had perished from a blast that size seems kind of unbelievable. That number ended up being increased to 30, by the way, but almost everyone believes that list is only limited to the people in and around the explosion when it actually happened. Even to this day, it's hard to know the exact number of people who were affected or killed because of the radiation. But it's safe to say it was more than 2 and more than 30. As for the trust but verify line we hear Chertoff say in the series, he is correct to say that it was not President Ronald Reagan who came up with that. But then again, most Americans at the time didn't think that he had come up with it either. This was in the era of the Cold War, so tensions between the United States and the Soviet Union were high. Reagan found out about the phrase when he was preparing to meet with the Soviet leader at the time, Mikhail Gorbachev. We actually see him in the series. That phrase was one that Reagan liked best of the Russian proverbs and sayings that he had done in kind of his research preparing to meet with Gorbachev. So he used it. Reagan used it. I don't think Gorbachev liked that Reagan used it. But since then, a number of American politicians have used the saying and then attributed it to Reagan. But that wasn't during the timeline of the series, and it wasn't Reagan who came up with it initially or even was trying to claim that he had come up with it initially. At the very end of the third episode, we see Vasily Ignatenko and other first responders being buried. There aren't many people there, but one of the people watching is Vasily's wife, Ludmila. Obviously, she's filled with emotion as she watches her husband be put into the ground in a metal coffin that's then covered with cement. It's hard to lose a loved one, and this was not a normal funeral. That is true, although there is more to the story. Again, the amount of radiation absorbed by the first responders and others closest to the exploded core was so high that officials were afraid their bodies would decompose in the ground and release radioactive materials into the ground that could then poison the water and so on. To avoid this, their bodies were put into plastic bags, then inside regular coffins, and those coffins were then sealed inside welded zinc caskets. Once they were buried, they were covered with cement. On top of that was the secrecy around it. The Soviet army was in charge of the funerals, and they wanted to keep everything a secret. So no foreign correspondents would know what was going on or the extent that they were going to try to contain the radioactivity of the bodies that could give an indicator as to just how bad the accident was. So they waited for hours before burying Vasily. Ludmila recalled being driven around for hours before finally getting to the cemetery. It's almost as if they were trying to lose a tail in case someone was following the car from the hospital to the cemetery. Finally, after everything she'd been through, watching her husband die a gruesome death at the hospital for 14 days, Ludmila had enough. She burst out in a flurry of emotion, and the Soviet colonel in the car finally gave the order to go to the cemetery. When they got to the cemetery, it was like they couldn't get it done fast enough. After waiting for hours, driving around for hours, now when they were at the cemetery, a minute or two, and it was done. The zinc caskets were lowered. There were people shouting, you know, do it faster. And then it was covered with cement. Ludmila then went back to the dormitory where she had been staying while her husband was in the hospital. And the whole time, someone was there making sure she didn't talk to anyone or anyone talk to her. The day after Vasily's burial, she was given a plane ticket and then again escorted, this time to the airport. As she recalled, when she got home, she slept for 3 whole days. If you want to hear Ludmila's words, again, I would highly recommend picking up a copy of the book Voices from Chernobyl by Svetlana Alexievich. In that book, Ludmila recounts what happened in her own words. It's so sad, I will warn you, it's a terrible way that Vasily died from radiation poisoning and what Ludmila had to go through. And all of this as she was only 23 years old. This episode of Based on a True Story was written and produced by me, Dan Lefebvre. If you want to learn more about the true story, I have a lot of great resources that I found in my research. Overall articles, timelines, explanations to technical papers written by scientists, engineers, as well as a link to that book that I mentioned at the end there with Ludmila's recollection of the events called Voices from Chernobyl by Svetlana Alexievich. All of those can be found at the show's home on the web. But I want to mention 3 books in particular that I loved and found super helpful in researching this episode. One is simply called Chernobyl by Serhii Plokhii. Then there's Midnight in Chernobyl by Adam Higginbotham. And Chernobyl, 12340, the incredible true story of the world's worst nuclear disaster by Andrew Leatherbarrow. You can find links to those books, all the resources, and follow the entire Chernobyl series in one place over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/Chernobyl. That's where all the episodes will be posted as they're released. Okay, now it's time for the answer to our two truths and a lie game from the beginning of the episode. As a refresher, here are the two truths and one lie. Number one, two of the three volunteers we see at the beginning of the episode actually died trying to turn the valves. Number two, the reactor exploded after the AZ-5 emergency shutoff button was pushed. Number three, Vasily Ignatenko's coffin was covered with cement. Did you find out which one is a lie? Let's start with number one. Two of the three volunteers we see at the beginning of the episode actually died trying to turn the valves. And right away, we have our lie. As we learned, the three men, Alexei Ananenko, Valery Bezpilov, and Boris Baranov, all survived turning the valves in radioactive water. Next is number two. The reactor exploded after the AZ-5 emergency shutoff button was pushed. Since we already know the lie, we know that number two is true. Both Toptunov and Akimov confirmed the AZ-5 button was pushed and then the reactor exploded. It made no sense to them at the time, but they were sure that's what happened. We already touched on it some in previous episodes, but we will continue to learn more about why that's important, why that made a difference as we continue our series. And last but not least is number three, Vasily Ignatenko's coffin was covered with cement. That is also true, as we learned he and others who had absorbed so much radiation that their bodies were at risk of contaminating the ground. Their coffins were put into zinc caskets that were welded shut, buried, and then covered with cement to contain the radiation. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. I hope you're enjoying this series. If you found it entertaining, if you find value in this podcast and you'd like to give a little of that value back, you can do that over at basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Once again, that's basedonatruestorypodcast.com/support. Until next time, thanks so much for listening, and I'll chat with you again really soon.